Welcome to Power Play, in a day when the West was in, at least in the Prime Minister's office. Coming up, the mayors of Calgary and Edmonton delivered their wish list to the Prime Minister in person today. We talked to both about setting their priority problems and interview Alberta's Energy Minister for her thoughts on Ottawa's outreach efforts. Tomorrow, by the way, Ontario Premier Doug Ford comes calling. I don't know what kind of welcome he'll get at the PMO. Also ahead, it's top of the polls as a priority for Canadians. We will ask the health minister about the challenge of keeping the baby boomers going and the younger generations healthy with limited dollars to give to the provinces. And what day would be complete without checking in with the Trump impeachment circus? Our bureau chief is standing by. But first, a familiar face who also faced down Western alienation as a prime minister came calling on the new government an hour or so ago. Here is some advice on dealing with Alberta angst from former Prime Minister Jean Chrétien.
Now, the Prime Minister is the Prime Minister of all the Canadians, all right? So when you're Prime Minister, you're not Prime Minister for one party. You're Prime Minister for all Canadians. And I'm sure that every Prime Minister understands that.
All right, let's find out what Alberta thinks about the cabinet scenario that's been complicated by the Liberal wipeout there in the last election. Let's take the pulse of the province as the Trudeau government tries to make peace in the West. Sonia Savage is the Alberta Energy Minister, and she joins us from the legislature. Minister Savage, there's rarely been an encouraging word about Ottawa helping Alberta in recent months, but are you feeling any hope for better relations in the aftermath of yesterday's shuffle?
Well, sure. I'm actually anticipating having a very good working relationship with Minister O'Regan. I spoke with him on the phone yesterday. I believe he was still in Rideau Hall. It was shortly after being sworn in. We had a very productive conversation. And as you know, he's coming out to Alberta today and we'll be meeting tomorrow to continue those discussions.
What's going to be number one on your priority list there when he walks into your office?
Well, we, of course, we're going to be advocating for Alberta's interests. Over the last 4 years in the past, things have not gone very well, and a lot of the policies and legislation and regulations out of Ottawa have damaged our energy industry. But we have a number of issues going forward that are critical to both Alberta and Canada. I outlined some of them. Of course, he's just new to the role. He hasn't been briefed yet. But tomorrow, hopefully, we can start talking about some of them. Things like how to get the Trans Mountain pipeline built, the need to ensure there's no delays in that. We've got the Tech Frontier oil sands mining project coming up for cabinet approval in Ottawa. We've got methane regulations, and of course we've got Bill C-69 and C-48 that we want to see some changes to.
Okay, well, it sounds like you're in the middle of Niagara Falls there, but I want to ask you is you've known Ottawa, you've been in Ottawa a lot in your previous in your previous job. Chrystia Freeland, I'm sure you're well aware of her as a person here. Is she the right person to listen to your concerns, or should there have been, in your view, a makeshift cabinet minister procured from somewhere in Alberta?
Well, we of course hope that our concerns will be heard and they'll listen to them, but what we actually need to see are some changes. So it's one thing to hear and understand our concerns, but we need some corrections from the policies over the last 4 years. So I'm sure they're all good at listening, but we need to see some changes. We can't have a continuation of the policies of the last 4 years. Things like C-69 and C-48, every single pipeline project has been canceled or delayed. And we're in a jobs crisis in Alberta, as you are well aware. And the biggest problem is our oil production exceeds our takeaway capacity. And that's a longstanding issue that needs to be corrected.
I got to ask you, I know you're concerned about this. That CN Rail strike's continuing. There's calls from the Railway Association to end it. How long can this go on before a back-to-work order becomes urgent?
Well, a back-to-work order is urgent now, today. We ship about 170,000 barrels a day of oil by rail, and we're already constrained on pipelines. We don't have enough pipeline capacity to move it. Rail is an interim solution, and 170,000 barrels a day that can't move means it's going to be either shut in or it's going to be piling up in storage. Either case is not acceptable to Alberta when we're already suffering, so it needs to be dealt with immediately. We wrote a letter, the Minister of Agriculture and the Minister of Transport and myself wrote a letter to the new Labour Minister. So we need that action. We need action on that right away.
Okay. I'm going to leave it there because I can hardly hear you. It sounds like there's a waterfall there. But Sonia Savage, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
We're in the legislature. Thank you.
All right. This brings us to the prominent Calgary Voice who came to town to meet with Prime Minister Justin Trudeau today. Let's find out what he discussed. All right. And the mayor of Calgary, my old hometown, Nahid Nenshi, joins me in the studio. Welcome.
I just had to come for the exit interview, Don.
That's what it is.
How many days left?
14. Anyway. All right. You had a meeting with the Prime Minister.
I did.
He promised to give you everything Alberta wants so the alienation temperature goes down. Is that right?
Done, and a giant check as well.
Okay. What was the big ask, and what is the big answer?
Well, you know, the conversation really was a broad conversation around the challenges we have in the country right now, and it's pretty serious. And it's something that we really, you know, it's not something I've felt before. And we really have got to do some work on it. And I have to say that the Prime Minister surprised me 36 hours after the polls closed when my phone rang with the 613 area code. And I thought it was interesting that he wanted to talk about Alberta and Saskatchewan right up front. I think that led to some drama on your part.
But, I thought you were going into cabinet. That's what I thought.
No, that was not what was on the table. But what was on the table was the opportunity to have a really important discussion about the roots and, more important, how to move forward on what is a very real issue. Yeah. Look, I don't believe in Wexit. You know, I always joke.
Why do you say that's idiotic? You
say I always idiotic. Say Wexit because Brexit is going so well. But it's based on something real. Like, fundamentally, of course, it makes no sense because small landlocked countries, that's not how you succeed in the world.
Not when you want to connect to an ocean.
Great. Mm. But we have to understand that these people are not crazy who are talking about it. These people have some very real frustrations. And it's important for us to understand the context of those frustrations.
You know, and I obviously defend Alberta interests when I get in these debates with my friends, but the question they ask that I don't have a clear answer for is, what, aside from Trans Mountain getting built, does Alberta really want? What does it expect out of Confederation?
Well, I think there's a couple of different things that we really need to think about. So the first is, and I think a lot of people out here, and you're an Albertan, so you get this, but I think a lot of folks across Canada don't really understand the psyche. And the way that I describe it is, look, even though we complain about it in good times, we're secretly kind of proud that our prosperity is helping the nation succeed. We're proud of bringing Canadians from all over the country in to live out their dreams in Alberta. But the unemployment rate in Calgary had been the lowest of any major city for many, many years. And it went from the lowest to the highest in 18 months. So this is a jarring dislocation. And people are very nervous about what the future holds. And they have every right to be. So, yeah, we need market access. Trans Mountain and others are important. We need to really talk about those two bills, 69 and 48, really start to get in the way of market access.
That's the tanker ban, just so everyone knows.
The tanker ban and the new environmental assessment on major national projects. Premier Kenney calls it the No More Pipelines bill, but it's actually much more than that. And we need to talk about thoughtful economic development. You know, this country has been doing regional economic development for a long time, with some success and some failure. But fundamentally, we're in a moment right now where some investments in economic development and attracting businesses to Calgary, where you've got this great workforce, where you've got this great business culture, could lead incredible dividends. And so in addition to that, there's all the things we need to do about investing in infrastructure and transit and climate change and so on. But those three things are fundamentally things we need to talk about in order to start mending some of the rift in our Confederation.
I want to get your quick thoughts, if I can, on Chrystia Freeland. She's kind of been given this file, but Jim Carr, unfortunately, is fighting cancer, but he's been given a step back role as a special representative on Western concerns. Is that enough for those tangible steps in your view?
You know, because I'm a mayor, I have to be optimistic. And they were both with me in the meeting with the Prime Minister this morning.
Okay.
And we had a very, what's the right political term? A frank and open exchange of views.
Forthright or whatever, yeah. Gotcha.
But we really did. And, you know, Minister Freeland, of course, people joke, well, she's Alberta born. That's as close as we are. She was actually raised in Peace River, Alberta. And her family is still there. But more important, I think that what we're looking at here is an opportunity for people to come in and really be thoughtful about this at the higher levels mm-hmm. of thinking in the provincial government, or in the federal government, rather. I'm not sure that that has always been there.
Right.
So look, I'm going to be a pain in the butt. I'm going to be a thorn in the side to really push on these neat, what Alberta requires. And I know Premier Kenney, my premier, and others will do that as well. But ultimately, I believe that people with the right attitude and the right thinking about our common interests and going forward can really build stuff. And fundamentally, I'm here to build and help build a better Canada. Mm-hmm. And I think that most Albertans are with me on that.
Is Kenny going about this the right way, in your view, the Premier?
Look, that's way above my pay scale. I'm just the mayor. He is really expressing forcefully something that is very real. And, you know, some would argue that we need to do it forcefully to get people to pay attention. Right. Some would use the parallel with the province of Quebec. In my mind, you know, these are all different goals to get to the same thing. Everyone wants prosperity for the nation.
Right.
Everyone wants to do so in a way that is environmentally sensitive. I think we can do it together. Doesn't mean I'm not going to be forceful. Doesn't mean I'm not going to push hard for what I think is needed, because I do think we're in a very dangerous time. But this is Canada.
Yep.
And, you know, I was saying earlier that I'm here actually in Ottawa. These meetings are a side benefit
mm-hmm.
because I'm actually here for the Global Pluralism Award. I sit on that jury.
Mm-hmm.
And last night we gave away 10 awards to people around the world working in really difficult conditions to try and bring people together. The folks in Hungary, where it is illegal to help migrants, you know, and I think to myself, geez, we get to live here.
Pretty lucky.
And careless words and actions and angry deeds could tear this apart so easily. Okay. Not going to happen on our watch.
All right. Any picks on the Grey Cup in Calgary this weekend?
Oh, I'm not allowed to pick.
No.
Because, you know, the Bombers beat the Stamps. Don't know how I feel about that. Hamilton has had an amazing season. Good news is I get to be the host and enjoy it regardless.
All right. Mayor Nenshi, always a pleasure having you on the show.
Thank you.
All right. Coming up, the mayor of Vancouver and the new federal minister who will be getting his big ask tomorrow. Please stay with us. Welcome back. Well, there was another mayoralty meeting with Trudeau today, but this came from the other side of the Great Divide. That's geographically, environmentally, and perhaps politically. Vancouver Mayor Kennedy Stewart, a former NDP MP, huddled with the Prime Minister to discuss a very different set of priorities. The mayor joins me in the studio.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Get over yourselves. You're telling Alberta to get over themselves.
Not Albertans. They're premiers.
Western, everybody.
They're premiers. They got to get over themselves. They got to get back to work. Well, got things to deliver.
But you don't think, you think that separation anxiety is not real or is fabricated?
Look, I sat in the house with Jason Kenney for 4 years, and I know what kind of politician he is, and he is stoking division, and I just don't want to get sucked into it. There's too many things to deliver. There's a housing crisis in Vancouver. We need new transit, and we have one person dying a day because of opioids. So I don't want to get caught up in theoretical debates about equalization payments. I need stuff on the ground now, and tying everybody up with these kind of esoteric discussions is not useful.
Okay, well, before we get to the civic wish list, I mean, I want to get your opinion on John Wilkinson. He's a BC MP. Mm-hmm. He's been named the environment minister. What's your view? Does he have the right stuff to sort of protect the environment, in your view?
Yeah, I mean, you know, served in the House of Commons with him as well. I flew lots of times back and forth from BC. I think he's a very, very capable minister, and I think he'll do really well on this file. I think there's a lot that we need to do on the environment. And, you know, Vancouver, we just declared a climate emergency, and we're taking big steps as a city, but we need a lot of help federally. And again, you know, British Columbians are up for it. I mean, we put the carbon tax in first by a right-wing, you know, BC Liberal government, mm-hmm. and now we're moving ahead. So we need help, and we're ready to lead, too, in Canada.
I know Jagmeet Singh's one of your MPs there, and he mm-hmm. certainly talks about social housing being the big concern. Is that your biggest concern? We'll get to the opioid crisis in a minute, but
yeah, he's right, and he's in my seat of Burnaby South, so he knows it well. Yeah, affordable housing is the biggest thing, and what we're finding is folks living on shelter rate market's not providing that. And even folks that are living now on minimum wage jobs, we're not building any, the market is not building anything that's providing for their needs. So we need the federal program that was put in, the National Housing Strategy, is working well. We just need the money out of the door faster. And that's why I'm here in Ottawa, is to talk to the housing minister, I think, right after this interview. So,
oh, really?
Yeah.
But did Trudeau give you any comfort on that particular file?
Oh, absolutely. He has for ever since I became mayor. He was the first leader to call me, and we started talking about what the priorities are. And $184 million in federal funding landed in Vancouver in August, and that we've already, we're just getting some temporary modular housing opening in February because of that funding. So I think, again, we're on the right track. There's lots of things we agree on, and that's what I want to focus on, is delivering for folks.
You've got a unique perspective as a big city mayor, in that you've sat in the House of Commons with Justin Trudeau when he was, I guess, when he was third party. No, you were in there when he was prime minister as well.
That's right. Yeah.
Did you sense anything different about him this time around? Is there a real, does it sound like the genuine listening commitment is there?
Yeah, this is a tough election. I mean, I was kind of thankful not to be in it. It was rough for all parties, I think. And it kind of hit a level where we'd, I don't think, been as a country. So I think people did a lot of learning. And I really felt that what I like is it feels like people are ready to get down to work. I mean, that's what I'm really hearing. There's not the grandstanding. There's not the yay, we're governmental change. It's like, there's a lot of stuff, for example, in the National Housing Strategy, there was $55 billion set aside. That now has to be delivered. We need stuff built. We need folks living in these houses, and transit too. We have, we have a big transit plan. We need investment, and that's why I'm here. But I'm getting very good positive signals from the Prime Minister and ministers I'm meeting with.
Just don't buy what they put in here in Ottawa. That doesn't seem to work very well. Final point, the opioid carnage continues. 4,000 a year. I think Paul Wells calculated it's taken 3 years to kill one third of all the Canadians who died in World War II. That's a pretty daunting thing. What do you want done that's not being done already?
Yeah, so we have one person dying a day in the city of Vancouver, and the toll it's taking, not just on the community that are addicted, it's also the frontline responders. I mean, I'm the chair of the police board as well, and the toll that this is taking on folks that are reviving the same person over and over again is just horrendous. So what we need to do is move towards safe supply. We have a harm reduction model that really originated in Vancouver, and the great thing is the public is ready to move on it. So safe supply would be, we've applied for a federal health grant, and we're hoping that we get it so we can move along. And I know a lot of other mayors are watching what we're doing because they're facing the same thing in their cities. And, we had the first supervised consumption site in 2003 open. So we've been dealing with this for a long time. Nobody was ever supposed to build one. Now they're going across the country. But the best thing is the public cares a lot. I'd say this is, besides housing, this is the second top issue, and because our neighbors are dying, and it makes sense to do work.
All right, Mayor Stewart, thanks for coming by. Appreciate it very much. Well, that makes a sad segue to my next guest, who will be handling the health portfolio and have responsibility for stopping the carnage of deaths across this country. Patty Hajdu is the new health minister. She joins me in the studio. All right, the mayor's heading out of here. He's got that meeting he was talking about. How can you respond to his concerns on that opioid crisis?
Well, first of all, it's such an honor for me to be appointed as a health minister, in part because I spent many of my professional years prior to politics working in the area of substance use and drug policy. And so when the mayor talks about the crisis that Vancouver is facing, this isn't a new crisis. This crisis existed 15 years ago. I was working in the field under a conservative Harper government that didn't believe in the crisis, that didn't think that this was a health crisis. In fact, criminalized people as the only solution to dealing with the problem. And so I'm excited to get started on actually furthering the work that we've been doing over the last 4 years.
All right. So he's going to make a specific request for federal funding help. I guess you're going to say wait and see.
Well, it's in the department now. And so, as you know, people apply for grants and the department does the assessment process. But barring any kind of crazy complication, I can't see why that grant wouldn't be successful if it meets the criteria of the grant. And since it's day two, you, I wouldn't be able to speak to its qualifications. But what I'll say is that we're looking forward to working really closely with municipal leaders, because in fact, we know that the solutions are at the local level. The mayor also talked about affordable housing. That's a key component, actually, in dealing with the opioid crisis. Mm-hmm. When people don't have a safe place to stay, when they don't have a roof over their head, it is almost impossible to be successful at any kind of treatment program. Mm-hmm. You can imagine the crisis of constantly worrying about whether or not you're safe outside as being a real deterrent to taking those really difficult steps in any kind of treatment program. So all of these things work together, and I'm really excited to hear the vision of the mayor of Vancouver and build on that kind of local knowledge that's going to help us move forward.
Speaking of visions out of BC, there's a doctor there, Ryan Day, who keeps trying to move the ball forward on private health care. He's got a clinic there, a surgical clinic, and there's a case in the Supreme Court. He says he's given up on political will to deal with the reality that there is a second tier of private health care going on. So he's going to the courts to say it's a constitutional issue. Is this government in any way going to fortify its resolve to enforcing the Canada Health Act, which suggests that accessibility should be an issue here that's protected? Or do you accept the fact that private health care is being delivered now for a fee pretty much everywhere, and you're going to have to let it grow?
You know, we believe in the principle of equity in terms of access to healthcare and affordability. And so, absolutely, we'll take every measure possible to make sure that healthcare access is affordable and equitable all across the country. And I'm looking forward to hearing more about that particular case. But I think Canadians are resolved in their perspective in terms of equity and our health, and protecting our universal healthcare system.
I'm going to keep being unfair and hitting you with health issues, even though you've been in the portfolio for about 30 hours now. Superbugs. We had a guest on the other day who was talking about, had did a study and showed like 400,000 Canadians will be hit by these bacteria, these microbes that are resistant to antibiotics in the next 30 years. He says we're way behind G7 countries in researching and attacking the problem, and yet we never hear a whisper about that. Is that something you're going to look into?
Absolutely. It's something we've been working on with our G7 partners. And you're right, I'm not fully briefed yet in terms of all of the steps that we've taken and the further steps that we have to take. But when in the very first briefing, the deputy minister tells me about this looming crisis and threat to our...
Oh, he talked about that to you?
Okay. He did, actually, this morning. And I've heard about it before, of course, through our former health minister. But we have to take this seriously. And I think, actually, journalists will have a role in this, because so many Canadians are unaware of the risks that they're facing as a result of the rise of these superbugs and antimicrobial resistance, which is a real thing and is threatens all of our health.
Yeah, you're right about that. One, I know this is awkward, but you, 24 hours ago, you were in charge of railways as labor minister of the railway strike. And this strike is starting to really bite Quebec. They're running out of propane. Oil's being held up. Saskatchewan's got the harvest ready to go. Why hold back on this? Don't you think this is a back-to-work order waiting to happen?
Well, first of all, we've always said as a government that we believe in collective bargaining and the right to collective bargaining for unions and corporations to get the agreement together is actually the best outcome. The parties remain at the table. We have the Federal Mediation Service with them. There are many of the issues have been resolved. And listen, you're absolutely right. This is essential to the economic prosperity of Canadians, but also the safety of Canadians. So we've been urging both parties to really buckle down and get that deal.
Okay. There's probably a limit to how much your hope will last, though, and then you'll say, back we go. But we're back in the House in 2 weeks. Maybe that's when you'll be looking at it.
Well, all I can say is that the fastest course of action to getting the trains running again is actually to get the deal at the table.
All right. Patty Hyde, congratulations on getting health. It's a huge portfolio and one that's top of mind for Canadians. So
go
help old people like me have a good life. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Coming up, the voice of the boardroom on whether this cabinet is business friendly. Please stay with us. Welcome back. Well, there's a maze of portfolios for business interests to navigate to find the right cabinet minister to arm twist in pursuit of their priorities. Let's get the pulse of business in the aftermath with Business Council of Canada President Goldie Hyder. He's in Toronto. Goldie, I counted 13 portfolios that could conceivably be you'd have to deal with on the Business Council interests, all mashed together, some reporting to each other. too many? Do you need a roadmap to find the right minister to deal with your concerns?
Well, look, I think every government's guilty of getting cute when it comes to some of these cabinet titles and appointments. But at the end of the day, let's be clear, you need to be, you know, aligned with the prime minister's office, and you need to make sure that your finance minister is your ultimate voice and champion of business and of economic of growth. That's the goal here, is how do we grow our economy?
Do you need a middle class prosperity minister, do you think, or is the middle class doing fairly well already?
Well, look, in all seriousness, I've often found it divisive to suggest that it's just about one class versus another. I'm struck by every prime minister on winning the election says, I'm here to govern for all Canadians, and then proceeds to talk about the middle class or small business versus large business or east versus west or one industry versus the other. That's unhealthy, Don, and I think it's sad at a time when our country is as divided as it is. Let me just say that this station and this country will miss your voice as you get ready for your own retirement, because you brought that Western sensibility to a national TV program, and a national unity is a very important issue at this time. And I'm hoping that these, what is really small ball politics gets aside, and that we're all able to work together to grow our economy with some urgency.
When does national unrest intersect with business investment interests? Is there a point where business starts getting enough red flags go up, the business says we should look elsewhere?
Look, I don't want to be a fear monger or overstate the point here, but you know, you and your viewers know. Business likes certainty. It likes confidence. We know what happened when we went through the whole Quebec issue. It did cause consequences for investment, because people who are investing our hard-earned cash capital want to know that it is going to a place that's reliable, that it is investing with some confidence and predictability. If we go into a scenario where, you know, not only are we having doubts about our country as a source of foreign investment, particularly in the energy sector because of our inability to build trade-enabling infrastructure, and then you add to it some unnecessary issue around national unity, because really the truth is not a lot of listening is required, as everybody in the talking point seem to be saying now. What's needed is action. We know what has to be done. We need to get on with building trade-enabling infrastructure, and I think Canadians are in support of that more than perhaps the news suggests on a daily basis.
I'm curious. Innovation seems to be one we all hear a lot of talk about. It's still lumped in with a number of other areas for the economic development minister. Is that something that needs a government kickstart? What's holding that back? We're way behind the G7 average.
Well, look, here I think it's on all of us. You know, business investment is also necessary to be driving that innovation. But that comes from when you're feeling confident about the economy and that you're able to grow your business, if you will, and to help create that drive to want to innovate, to want to get away. We have a culture, as you know, Don, in Canada, that's a little too comfortable, a little too complacent. We're blessed by our geography, but also cursed by our geography by being next to the United States. And we needed a jolt, and we need a shake. And this is part of the reason I'm saying that we need to pay more attention to what's going on. Countries that we're thinking of as emerging markets or, you know, in the third world are surpassing us. They're working harder. They're accelerating their growth strategies. And innovation is core to that. We have a lot of good things going on in Canada. Don't get me wrong. There's a lot of innovation in Montreal and Toronto and other places. The supercluster program, I know there are some who roll their eyes about it, but I think it's got potential to become something. We in the business community are working hard to make sure that there is more innovation taking place, not less.
One thing, and there's the domestic front, but then there's the need to get products to new markets. There's the rail strike that's obviously compromising that happening, but there's also China, and there's concerns about the U.S. How concerned are you that Canada's facing a lot of drawbridges and obstacles to getting to other markets?
Very concerned is the short answer. I mean, let's be clear here. The headwinds are getting stronger and stronger. I just came back from 2 weeks in Asia and China and in Japan. The economic slowdown is occurring globally. Part of it is being driven by the angst around the trade war that you referenced and the tariffs and the rising protectionism. But the only way to combat all of that is to have an economic plan and an economic strategy. And many of the things in Canada, Don, are self-imposed. I mean, when you look at the interprovincial trade barrier issue, it is reported that just removing those barriers would grow your GDP by 4%, which is quite a bit when you consider our GDP growth is only 1.5% today. And so things like that, things like not being able to build our pipelines, not being able to get access to markets, and or our foreign policy and our trade policy being a little too moralistic. You know, we need to be very pragmatic and sensible in how we play in this whole new world, because what got us here is no longer good enough to get us to the next place.
All right. Goldie Hyder, always a pleasure having you on. Thank you, sir.
Great to being on, having me on, Don. Thank you so much.
All right. Coming up, the impeachment inquiry continues to steamroll Donald Trump's version of events. We get the latest from Washington. Please stay with us.
Ambassador Bolton had looked pained, basically indicated with body language that there was nothing much that we could do about it. And he then, in the course of that discussion, said that Rudy Giuliani was a hand grenade that was going to blow everyone up.
Did you understand what he meant by that?
I did, actually.
What did he mean?
Well, I think he meant that, obviously, what Mr. Giuliani was saying was pretty explosive in any case. He was frequently on television making quite incendiary remarks about everyone involved in this.
All right, another day of hearings, another day of bad news for President Donald Trump and his little hand grenade Giuliani. Let's go to Washington for the latest from Bureau Chief Joy Melvin. Help me with a roadmap here, Joy. Who is saying what today about the U.S. president's behavior at the inquiry?
Well, let me set the scene here. Gordon Sondland, a handpicked ambassador by Donald Trump, if he was the bombshell yesterday, today, Fiona Hill, she was the bomb. I mean, she just laid waste to Republicans and these conspiracy theories that somehow Ukraine was responsible for political interference in the 2016 U.S. election. But she also, you know, made the connection that was absolutely undeniable here, that these investigations that Donald Trump wanted were connected to the Bidens and political gain. You played that clip about John Bolton. That was her boss. And he said, you know, when Rudy Giuliani gets involved, you know, this whole thing is just going to blow up. He said he didn't want to be part of any kind of drug deal. And he told her to report this to National Security Council lawyers, which she did. The other witness today was David Holmes, another career diplomat. And he had a very dramatic moment because he heard President Trump on a phone call with the ambassador, Gordon Sondland, handpicked from, Donald Trump, where Trump says specifically, how are those investigations going? And, you know, he says, you know, he was holding the phone like this so that everyone could hear because Donald Trump has such a distinctive, loud voice. So these two made the connection today, you know, adding on to what the other witnesses are saying, that this was a quid pro quo, that the president wanted investigations into a political rival, and he was dangling a White House visit and possibly withholding military aid in exchange for it.
You know, we've got this undeniable reality now, but it doesn't seem to impact how Republicans look at him. It doesn't seem likely to impact the Senate vote on the actual impeachment. So I guess we're just listening to a story that finally Trump's going to say, no big deal, nothing to see here. Sure, I did it. What the heck are you going to do about it?
Absolutely. I mean, this is the reality of this very politically divided country. Wrapping up this hearing today, one of the most moderate Republicans, William Hurd from Texas, who's retiring, he's got nothing to lose here. And he said, you know what, after listening to all of this, you know, 9 witnesses, 2 weeks of testimony, I don't see the evidence. I don't see the impeachable defense. But Democrats, Adam Schiff, who has been leading this, these hearings, he's right. Quite emotional, saying that this president is dangerous. This is a bad thing for our country. But yeah, are we headed towards impeachment? Very likely. But as one Republican said, bring it over to the Senate. And you know what? We'll clean this mess up.
Okay, I'm curious to get your thoughts. I didn't watch the debate last night of the Democrat candidates. I'm wondering, amongst them, was there a knockout or a knockdown, or was nothing, no damage done to anybody?
You know what? When I think about the Democratic debate, it's kind of like who was listening. It was the viewership was very low, but I did watch some of it when I got home from covering the impeachment hearings. And I would have to say the thing that struck me the most, the best line, Cory Booker. He was talking about Joe Biden's plan to about marijuana. And he says, you know, Joe, I thought you were high when you said that marijuana shouldn't be legalized. That got a big laugh. But then, you know, I saw a very shaky Joe Biden, who is, you know, for many people, many moderate Democrats, their great hope. And he was talking about the black community, how they're behind him. And he said, you know, I swore in, a black senator, a woman. And Kamala Harris is standing there going, yeah, that was me. It was very stunning. It was kind of weird. Terms of winners, I can't really say because no one's paying attention. Of course, people are paying attention. But, you know, until next year, it's all about Donald Trump and impeachment right now.
Oh, dear. All right, Joy. Thanks very much. We appreciate your input as always.
Thanks.
All right, after these messages, the press gallery on the oddities and the shuffle. We look at the pretend portfolios in Trudeau's new cabinet. And my last word on the Chrystia Freeland exemption from PMO control. Please stay with us. Welcome back. It's Thursday, and that means the CTV All-Star duo of classic vintage journalists are here to put the reality check to the big stories of the day. Joyce Napier is not really very vintage, but she's a classic as our bureau chief. Craig Oliver is both vintage and classic as our political commentator. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
There's some weird names in the cabinet shuffle. Joyce, you were getting hypothermic down there at Rita Hall yesterday.
It was fun.
Tell me about some of the... I mean, it used to be very straightforward. You have a finance minister, a justice minister, and a defense minister.
You knew what their jobs were.
No, yeah. But times are changing now. You don't necessarily need what their jobs are.
I mean, tell me something.
I like the middle class prosperity.
Well, what does that do?
Well, it's prosperity for the middle class. it's everybody's for that. Yeah. You know, I mean, it is like minister for the angels. We all wish
minister
prosperity.
Minister of unicorns next or what?
And so that one is kind of interesting. I thought that. The inclusion, there's a ministry.
Diversity, inclusion, and youth.
Yes.
Well, what do you make of that, Craig Oliver?
Well, basically, that's what Carla Qualtro does. So there is a lot of overlap in these kind of ministries. And these aren't real ministries anyway. They're basically speechifiers. It's like campaign buttons, and there isn't much behind what the minister's doing in the terms of actual work, in terms of an organization or a line responsibility. They're promoters. That's what they are. They're promoting the government line as if you're covered. I mean, there's a game here. You might call it, hey, have I got a minister for you?
But isn't it like the old minister of states they used to have that weren't really full on portfolios?
Don't have a department.
Like but now
the
they're all departments.
Of middle class prosperity is the Department of Finance, really,
yeah.
Right? So they don't really have a department. There isn't like the Ministry of, you know, what is it called? Middle class prosperity. It is part of the finance department. So what exactly would this minister's mandate be? And when we read the mandate letters, right. And because we haven't seen them, let's see exactly what they're mandated, because it seems that there's six or seven economic development portfolios here. And how do you separate rural economic development with just simple economic development, for instance?
Well,
right?
Yeah, and one of them is also kind of women's studies and rural economic development. I mean, what? But if we have a ministry of, what was it, middle-class prosperity, that must mean that the finance minister is responsible for high-value adults and big corporations, since he doesn't have to worry about middle-class prosperity because the minister over there doing it all for him, lucky guy.
All right. I'll move on because, Joyce, you covered the Middle East as a journalist, and I'm curious as about what you think of Canada. It had 14 years where it sort of didn't vote with... Well, let me have to, the United States, there was a vote yesterday, Canada on the Palestinian question and Israel. What was the vote about? And how significant was the fact that we changed a little bit on that front?
Well, you know, the thing is that we didn't change. In fact, we voted according to our foreign policy. But what it was is, do you remember Mike Pompeo announced this week that Washington no longer thinks that these Israeli settlements in the West Bank are illegal under international law, right? Or contravene, if you wish, international law, which has been the State Department's policy since 1978. So in one statement, Mr. Pompeo changed the America's foreign policy on these issues. And you know, Canada believes in a two-state solution, in Palestinians' right to self-determination. And Canada also has always thought, or the Canadian foreign policy, that these settlements, these Israeli civilian settlements in the West Bank, contravene international law. And Canada just voted that way in at the UN. Did not vote with Israel, did not vote with the United States, and actually did not even abstain like it did when Donald Trump moved his embassy in Israel from Jerusalem to Tel Aviv.
As they say in German, it macht nicht, means nothing. What this is all about is getting that hopeless effort to get Canada in the Security Council and get all of those Arab and other anti-Israeli or whatever votes. That's what it's all about. And we have no chance. Ireland does a lot more in terms of peacekeeping than Canada does. And Norway has got all kinds of pluses that we don't have in terms of assistance to Africa and other countries. So we haven't got a chance of getting that. And I don't know why they keep pushing ahead with that idea, because we're going to get the prime minister's.
The significance of the vote is that Canada voted in accordance with its position in the Middle East and with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Okay. Yeah. Last point. Doug Ford comes to meet Justin Trudeau tomorrow. This is the guy that Justin Trudeau spent 40 days of campaigning against, probably more so than Andrew Scheer. I would be a fly on that wall, but can they kiss and make up after all that?
Or a spider under the table. I don't care which insect, but I'd love to be there. I can imagine that it will be a little bit awkward. What is Trudeau has to tell him? Okay, you know, it was a campaign. It's true that when you campaign with a baseball bat. When you govern, you have to govern with kid gloves. So I'd be interested in the tone tomorrow, and also the fact that Doug Ford disappeared during that campaign as well. So obviously there was some truth in, you know, campaigning against Doug Ford in Ontario served the Liberals well enough.
I think most people think it did have, in some ways, a significant effect on the outcome of that vote, because Ford has been so unpopular and they ran against him. But this also has effect on our new deputy prime minister, and I wonder if she'll be at the meeting, because she is the Minister of Intergovernmental Affairs, and she's going to have to deal with him on any number of issues, including pharmacare, all kinds of things.
And that's a real ministry.
And so this is going to be, I think, we'll get some idea of the difficulty she's going to have. Never mind the West. And what about Quebec, remember? That is part of her job, too, making deals with the government of Quebec, which will not be easy.
Okay, 20 seconds or less, Joyce. Is this outreach going to keep going right across the country? Has Trudeau got a lineup of people to meet over the next...
Absolutely, and that's what he's doing. But, you know, Jean Chrétien, former prime minister, was there. He walked into the prime minister's office, but he spoke to reporters, said one thing. Prime minister is a minister, prime minister of all Canadians. So I guess that's what he's trying to do.
All right. All right. Thank you both. We are out of time. Appreciate that. We'll see you next week. Week after next. All right. Time for the last word. Well, if the new crop of cabinet ministers appear a little lost for words beyond gushing thanks for their $85,000 pay raise, it's because they don't yet know what to think. Their marching orders haven't arrived. The mandate letters, still being penned by the Prime Minister's office, will soon come down from on high as commandments carved into stone tablets. Those who do not faithfully obey every word will endure fire, brimstone, and, as Jody Wilson-Raybould found out, demotion and dumping. So let us put to rest the notion that cabinet ministers actually set the agenda for action in their portfolios. They merely and meekly follow orders from the PMO. This is realism, not cynicism, and it has been this way through many prime ministers. But there is one exception to the rule in this week's cabinet swearing-in. It's the Chrystia Freeland waiver. Whether Freeland deserves the rapture she receives in media coverage is debatable. There are foreign affairs files where she's clearly fell flat. But the new deputy prime minister has been given the power to initiate change on the fly in the pursuit of national unity. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau clearly believes she is the best way to keep his badly wounded brand away from files that would be hurt, not helped, by his personal intervention. It's all part of a remarkable transformation in Trudeau's style, if not substance. Gone is the loose tie, the rolled-up sleeves of a prime minister relishing the adoration of crowds and cameras. Now it's all business suits, minus any sign of his picture-perfect family in tow, as Trudeau does a reasonable facsimile of Stephen Harper sneaking in and out of back doors. So enter Freeland to share power and hopefully get the West back in and Ontario on side. She brings some promising abilities to the daunting task. Freeland has the brains to know how to win without gloating and when to accept a retreat to save the day. She will not cower from the trifecta of trouble known as Premiers Ford, Kenney, and Moe, but she won't ideologically bait them needlessly either. She will listen first and act when necessary without waiting for the PMO to launch massive, meaningless consultation blitzes. So, for ministers of lesser stature, enjoy those briefing books and rehearsing for parliamentary battle under remote control from mandate letters. Thankfully, there's one who can act without permission from a PMO that's largely drained of superior staffing talent. In a very tangible way, the prime minister's job has suddenly achieved gender parity as a shared responsibility. And why not? Because, after all, it's 2019. That's the last word, and that's your Power Play Day in Politics. I'll be away next week. Joyce Napier, right here, will be in the host chair. Hope you can join us. Have a great evening.